Any threat or pressure will not threaten the DPRK or block its path towards strengthening nuclear deterrence.
Japan boosts its defense spending. It's Friday, September 1st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, diverging comments on North Korea, a deepening refugee crisis in Myanmar, India hard hit by floods, more water coming from the Arctic, a movie about an author. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japan's defense ministry Thursday proposed a 2.5% boost in defense spending to purchase stealth aircraft, build warships, and develop longer-range anti-missile defenses to counter what is perceived as a growing threat from China and North Korea. The fiscal 2018 budget beginning April 1st would amount to $48 billion. The announcement came a day after President Donald Trump tweeted that talking with North Korea is not the answer to easing tensions. He said for 25 years the United States has been talking to Pyongyang and paid them extortion money. Pressed by reporters Wednesday, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, meeting with his South Korean counterpart, said no to the question of whether diplomatic efforts have been exhausted.
We're never out of diplomatic solutions. We continue to work together, and the minister and I share a responsibility to provide for the protection of our nations, our populations, and our interests, which is what we are here to discuss today, and look for all the areas which we can collaborate with already very strong collaboration. We always look for more. We're never complacent.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in a phone call with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, warned military action against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs would be fraught with unpredictable consequences. And in Geneva Wednesday, North Korean diplomat Ju Yong-chol denounced Tuesday's UN Security Council statement condemning its latest ballistic missile test over Japan, calling it a product of a hostile U.S. policy.
U.S. is wholly responsible for the escalation of the current tension on the Korean Peninsula. U.S. and its followers should bear in mind that any threat or pressure will not threaten the DPRK or block its path towards strengthening nuclear deterrence to protect its sovereignty against the U.S. hostile policy and nuclear threat.
Japan is seeking tougher U.N. Security Council sanctions following Pyongyang's latest missile launch. Mr. Trump's latest tweet drew criticism, but Tufts University Korea analyst Sun-Yung Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty past U.S. aid to Pyongyang can be considered to have been extortion money.
It is the fact. The U.S. between 1995 and 2008, according to the Congressional Research Service, has provided North Korea with over $1.3 billion in aid, consisting mostly of food and fuel aid. To put that in perspective, in the mid to late 1990s, North Korea's total export earnings were less than $500 million a year. So as North Korea was going through a hard time, the United States was giving North Korea a lot of aid. Was it humanitarian assistance? Not exactly. It was payoff, extortion money. For example, ever since North Korea fired a missile over Japan for the first time in August 1998, the United States has been inclined to try to get North Korea out of the headlines for a while so that the North Korea threat would not grow into even a bigger political liability or headache, and the U.S. has been inclined to pay North Korea. So what Trump said is factually correct, and I think that is a constructive message, a strong message to North Korea and to China, and perhaps even to South Korea, which is quite eager to return to that kind of unconditional aid to North Korea.
Japan is pushing the U.S. to propose new U.N. Security Council sanctions on North Korea following its latest missile test, possibly targeting the country's laborers who work abroad, the oil supply to North Korea, and its textile exports. Would the Security Council go along with such tough sanctions?
It remains to be seen. I think it's possible that China and Russia would go along after, you know, lengthy, protracted negotiations with the United States and U.S. supporters of the United States. But the problem is not that we don't have tough sanctions on paper, but that we have not uniformly enforced these sanctions. So with that in mind, China could go along with even intensifying sanctions against North Korea, but China will probably fail to enforce those sanctions after a decent interval of maybe 3 to 4 months. So yes, it is possible, and it is the right thing to do. At the same time, you know, the same old refrain of this is an unacceptable provocation, it's serious, there'll be serious consequences for North Korea. We have heard that coming out of Washington, Tokyo, Seoul, and Beijing for the past 25 years. So in the short term, I'm not very optimistic. I don't think there'll be any meaningful change in North Korean behavior.
Two U.S. B-1B bombers Thursday flew over South Korea along with four F-35 stealth fighters, joining South Korean warplanes in an apparent show of force 2 days after the latest North Korean missile launch. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. U.S. flies bombers, F-35 fighter jets over Korean Peninsula. Pakistani police officers sentenced in Bhutto murder trial. End of border standoff with China satisfies India, but it will not lower its guard. Pope Francis's visit to Myanmar raises hopes and concerns. Americans fly out from North Korea before U.S. travel ban. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The U.S. President and his Defense Secretary issued divergent comments Wednesday about how to respond to North Korea's advancing ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the comments come as North Korea receives worldwide condemnation for its most recent missile launch.
North Korea says it's the first step toward containing U.S. forces in the region. The medium-range ballistic missile flew over Japan, setting off sirens that sent residents scurrying for cover. The UN Security Council condemned the launch as outrageous. In a statement, President Donald Trump warned all options are on the table. But on Wednesday, a different message from Trump, saying via Twitter, talking is not the answer. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis, meeting with Seoul's foreign minister, was quick to offer a different view.
No, we're never out of diplomatic solutions. We continue to work together. And the minister and I share a responsibility to provide for the protection of our nations, our populations, and our interests, which is what we are here to discuss today.
Trump has a long history of making controversial statements about Pyongyang.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
That comment coming earlier this month. 4 months before that, Trump said he'd be honored to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un face-to-face. And during the campaign, Trump said he'd both be willing to host Kim at the White House and also threatened to have China get rid of him. That risks sending mixed messages, says Gary Seymour, a top Obama non-proliferation official via Skype.
Well, it's a little difficult for me to interpret what President Trump has in mind. All I can say is that the Trump administration's policy has been trying to persuade North Korea through economic pressure, as well as promises of progress to resume negotiations.
The U.S. this week continued its show of force by conducting regular military exercises with South Korea and by releasing video of a successful medium-range missile intercept test off the coast of Hawaii. The problem is, if North Korea's recent missile tests are any indication, it isn't ready to give in anytime soon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi travels to China for a summit of emerging nations beginning Sunday, following the resolution of their most serious border confrontation in decades in a disputed Himalayan plateau. For now, it appears China has abandoned plans, to build a contentious road near India and Bhutan. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by. Bangladesh authorities on Thursday recovered the bodies of several Rohingya Muslim refugees, including children, after their boat capsized on the Naf River while escaping a security crackdown in neighboring Myanmar, also known as Burma. They were believed to have been among the more than 18,000 people fleeing nearly a week of violence in rest of Western Rakhine State, which has left more than 100 dead since insurgents launched coordinated attacks against Myanmar security forces. The UN Security Council was briefed on the violence Wednesday. The United Kingdom's ambassador, Matthew Rycroft, said the council looks to State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi to set the right tone and find a resolution to the conflict. Vikram Nehru, a non-resident senior fellow on the Southeast Asia at the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, tells VOA this could be the biggest crisis Western Myanmar has ever faced.
There is real concern that it is a tinderbox and it could explode at any time. Unfortunately, the reaction of the military to what were clearly unjustified killings that need to be condemned by this group of militants. Nevertheless, the reactions of the military have been out of proportion, and I think the Burmese government should realize the more oppressive the armed forces are in that area, the worse is going to be the reaction from the militants. This is a time to step back and to think through what can be done to calm the situation, to reduce the violence, and to try and get to the core of the problem. And the core of the problem is that there are large numbers of people in that area who don't have any rights whatsoever.
He says Aung San Suu Kyi has been relatively silent on the issue for a number of reasons.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been quite right from the very beginning, even before her government was elected into office and after she became state councillor. Her statements have been ambivalent towards the Rohingya community. And in part, this is because I think she is constrained in her actions by the military, which continue to retain the important levers of society and of power in the country. But also, I think she really does represent the views of the majority of the Myanmar population, which is that the Rohingya community doesn't belong in Myanmar. The same community is rejected by Bangladesh. As a result, they are literally stateless people without any rights. Even though they may have been living in Myanmar for decades and some perhaps for generations, the reality is that they don't have any rights of citizenship in either Myanmar or in Bangladesh. And consequently, they are deserving of special treatment by the international community, but also by both governments, Bangladesh as well as Myanmar.
Vikram Nehru says the conflict is not so much between majority Buddhist and minority Muslims within the country. Instead, the minority is not recognized as part of the country at all.
There is a virtually universal opinion across Myanmar, all strata of society throughout the country, that they don't consider them part of Myanmar. They don't believe they're even an ethnic community within Myanmar. They consider them to be Bengali immigrants, which, of course, is not true because many of them have been living in Myanmar now, as I said, some for generations.
Vikram Nehru fears that while it shouldn't upend Myanmar's democratic reforms, it could, if left unresolved, put the Southeast Asian nation on the path of a huge humanitarian crisis. He said the supreme irony is that the more repressive the security crackdown is, the more militant the insurgent reaction is likely to be. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, two police officers have been sentenced to 17 years in prison for failing to protect assassinated former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto in 2007. The officers are the first two people to be convicted in Bhutto's murder case after the nearly decade-long trial. Follow the big stories? Enjoy a variety of features at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. Massive flooding continues to inundate many parts of India. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi about the difficult situation, complicated in Mumbai by a building collapse.
Rescue workers are trying to pull people out of the rubble. This was a five-story residential building. It was a 117-year-old structure that had already been declared unsafe 6 years ago. So the speculation is that Tuesday's torrential rains further weakened it. It housed about 12 families. At latest count that we have is 16 people are dead. About 28 people have been pulled out alive, but several are still missing. So rescue work is still going on.
Now, Mumbai, as we know, is a mega city, about 20 million people, and it's just about at sea level. Is there an overall flooding problem there with a lot of rain?
Absolutely. Mumbai's problem of flooding is very distinct from what South Asia is suffering. This was a case of urban flooding, basically caused by very poor urban planning that has resulted in choking the drainage system in the city, as you say, of 20 million people. So on Tuesday, when it received as much rain in a day as it does on an average in a month, it sort of virtually drowned in knee-deep water with traffic coming to a near halt. The civic authorities have come in for a lot of flak. There are questions raised every year before the monsoons. Are they prepared? But unfortunately, the city continues to suffer.
We're getting reports that there is flooding basically in many, many areas of South Asia. What can you tell us about that?
Yes. You know, Bangladesh, Nepal, and the eastern region of India, this is really in the Himalayan foothills, are suffering some of their worst flooding. This has triggered heavy monsoon rains and overflowing rivers that cascade down to the plains from the Himalayas. From reports that we have, about a third of Nepal is submerged. Huge areas of Bangladesh are inundated, and three states in India, in the northeast and east, are also witnessing flood havoc. Of course, it's poor communities who are affected the worst. You know, they are the ones who live in the floodplains. Some villages are completely cut off, and the only way to get food and other aid to them is by boat. That's what we are told by the aid agencies. You know, the monsoon season runs from June to September, but we have seen some heavy rain in August that has led to the inundation. A bulk of the casualties, 1,200 people are supposed to have died, are in India, the rest in Bangladesh and Nepal. In addition to a million homes being washed away, about 18,000 schools have been damaged, and it's rural communities which are affected the most.
Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This news alert from VOA Asia. The United States and its allies have once again responded to a North Korean missile test, but this time the response included live fire exercises. Two B-1 bombers from a base in Guam, along with four F-35 fighter jets from a base in Japan, participated in a 10-hour show of force mission over the Korean Peninsula. Stay up to date. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the oceans are rising faster and faster, threatening coastal cities around the world. The quickening pace is due in part to changes happening in the Arctic that scientists say they're just beginning to understand. From Greenland, VOA's Steve Barragona reports on how warming temperatures are driving more warming.
The frozen Arctic is thawing, and as it thaws, it's coming to life. It's not just the longer growing season. Underground, the Arctic permafrost is retreating, says ecologist Ross Virginia.
More of it was previously frozen soil, locked from away from biology, essentially inert, is now becoming biologically alive.
And like all living things, soil breathes. Scientists are measuring the gases exhaled by the bacteria and fungi living in the growing layer of soil. They are finding the microbes are producing worrying amounts of carbon dioxide and methane.
And those are potent greenhouse gases. So then the atmosphere warms more, and we get more thaw of the permafrost, more gases being emitted, which leads to more warming.
That's just one of the vicious cycles that are spinning faster as the Arctic warms. Another is happening out on the ice, says atmospheric scientist Jim McQuaid.
Bright snow reflects sunlight, so it doesn't melt as quick. But as soon as you start darkening the snow, the speed of this melting increases.
And the Greenland ice sheet is getting darker. Though it seems isolated from the rest of the world, McQuaid says desert dust, industrial soot, and smoke from forest fires blow in from far away. McQuaid is part of a team studying how these darkening particles interact with microbes growing on the ice. They produce dark pigments to shield themselves from the unrelenting sun. McQuaid says the microbes, dust, and soot form into globs that create pockmarks in the ice.
They're dark, they'll start to warm up and then melt into the snow or the ice. And as one melts and then you get another one melts and then they'll start joining together, so you get this water forming.
The more water that melts, the more the microbes can grow, leading to more melting. Scientists do not yet know how big an impact these self-sustaining cycles will have, but Ross Virginia says researchers have been caught off guard.
We've been underestimating rates of change, and it's because we're now understanding these feedbacks that we really need to dig into and understand how physical change affects biology, how biology drives physical change.
Change that's happening faster and faster. Steve Barragona, VOA News, outside Kangerlussuaq, Greenland.
As the weekend approaches, it may be time to take in a movie. Here's one. Oscar winner Brie Larson leads the cast in a new movie that tells the story of author Jeanette Walls. As VOA Asia's David Byrd tells us, Woody Harrelson and Naomi Watts also star in The Glass Castle.
Rich city folk live in fancy apartments, but their air is so polluted they can't even see the stars. We'd have to be out of our minds to trade places with any of them.
Dr. Taylor said we should go to real school.
A real school, huh?
This is as real as it gets, kids. You learn from living.
The Glass Castle recounts the unconventional and often poverty-stricken upbringing of author Jeanette Walls and her four siblings. Based on the 2005 memoir of the same name, the movie stars Brie Larson as Jeanette, the second of four children born to Rex and Rosemary Walls. Rex is an alcoholic and Rosemary is an artist and teacher, but neither parent can provide the stability their four children need. At the movie's premiere, Larson, who won the Oscar for her portrayal of a kidnapped mother in last year's Room, says that Jeanette's story shows the resilience of the human spirit.
For me, this is a story about humans and how strong and resilient they are, and that life can throw a lot at you, and that we somehow pick ourselves back up and still have this incredible capacity to love again and to care and to keep going. So to me, this is a film about a testament of survivors, that every human being is a survivor. We've all survived something, and we keep going, and it's such a wonder that we're here.
Naomi Watts plays Jeanette's mother, Rosemary. She says that the cast members truly bonded during the production and were able to tell this powerful story.
We connected with this story. We brought our own stories to the table, and it was kind of a cathartic experience, and we had all the joy, all the fun, and also the stuff that would makes you so emotional as well. Like, obviously not as extreme as Jeanette's stories, but, you know, there are stuff that you could easily relate to.
Woody Harrelson plays Jeanette's father, Rex. He says that he agrees with some of Rex's methods, even if they are unconventional.
Education is, better when it's experiential, better to get out in nature and just actually experience what it is you're talking about as opposed to sitting in a classroom. Some of his views on medical system I tend to agree with.
Brie Larson says that she hopes that Jeanette Walls is pleased with her portrayal.
She's just an incredible person that continues to inspire me, and I hope will be a very big part of my life for many years to come. Her capacity to accept and move and find strength and her way with words is just so incredibly powerful to me.
The Glass Castle is directed by Destin Daniel Cretton, who also directed Larson in 2013's Short Term 12 and directed this year's The Shack. It is distributed in the U.S. by Lionsgate and is rated PG-13. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We say hello to everyone who's listening at DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. In Diliman, Quezon City, the Philippines. Thanks for joining us today. And thanks wherever you have listened to us around the world. Don't forget, check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can send us a message there as well. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a great day.